want to say thanks to the Mischievous Mermaid for yet another great show. Thanks a lot. It's always great to see you. And coming up on 5 o'clock here for the Hemp Show. Take care of yourself. All right, enjoy this rain. All right. Take care. This is KKCR Honolulu, a.k.a. QA, KLON, also K224CQ in Honolulu, and K284AL in Haleiwa. And we're coming up on the Kauai Island Hemp Show, and it's made possible by listeners like you in partnership with Kauai Coffee and Kalaheo Chiropractic.
Kauai Coffee Company. The Kauai Coffee Estate is located on Highway 540. Walking tour and samples of all of our coffees available. 100% Island Estate grown Kauai coffee. More information online at kauaicoffee.com.
Kalaheo Wellness Center, natural pain relief services, providing gentle chiropractic acupuncture, therapeutic massage, nutritional wellness, postural training, cold laser therapy, and spinal decompression. Open Monday through Friday, now a second location in Kapa'a, 822-0711, or Southside Center at 332-5580, or online at kalaheochiropractic.com.
Oh, thank you so much for supporting Kauai Community Radio.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
Kauai Island Hemp Show, and right now we're just waiting for a phone call from today our guest will be Barney Wharf. He's a professor of the Department of Geography at the University of Kansas, and he's going to be calling in a little bit from Kansas. He's staying up late so he can join us today. And so while we're waiting, the Surfrider Blue Water Task Force did their February results of the canals and streams, or the and less than 10 is considered safe, and some of the safe beaches on Kauai are, or surf spots, is Anahola Bay, Kapa'a Reef, Kapa'a Beach Park, Kealia, Pine Trees, Rock Quarries, Lydgate, Salt Pond, Kalapaki Bay, Kali'iwai, PKs, Pakalas, and Lumahai Stream. Tell us a little bit about our guest, and we're going to come back, and I'm going to answer the phone and see how it works.
Okay, I think, okay, am I on? Okay, there we go. Barney Wharf, he's a professor at the Department of Geography at the University of Kansas in Kansas City, and he's written quite a few books, and he's on tour speaking about this subject throughout the Midwest, and I think that you're going to really enjoy hearing from him. So, Barney, are you there?
Yeah, I can barely hear you, though.
Okay, he can barely hear us. Okay, so...
Is that better?
Hello? Can you hear us now?
It's a little better.
A little better. How about, can we improve that?
That's about as good as we're going to get right there.
That's
so it should work.
Okay. Okay. I hope this is okay. Barney, why don't we start off by you sort of giving a self-introduction and who you are and how you came to be an expert on marijuana and all the ins and outs of it.
Well, first of all, I wouldn't call myself an expert per se. I have an interest in it, and I've written about it, but there are people who know much more about it than I do. I'm a professor of geography at the University of Kansas, and I write about a variety of things, but I look at the world through the lens of social theory and political economy. And the interest in cannabis is actually sort of a side line of research for me, but I've been interested in cannabis at a personal and professional level for a long time. And in part, I've been motivated by what I think are the outrageous laws against cannabis that we've seen in the U.S., some of which have recently been rescinded. But I look at the war on cannabis as a racial and class war, and I view it as an issue of social justice and involving race and other issues there.
Mm-hmm.
So my motivation is largely moral in origin.
Okay, that's excellent. I think that we're going to be touching on each and every one of those subjects as we get through this hour. So why don't we start with when and where did marijuana become domesticated?
When and where what?
Did marijuana become domesticated?
Okay, well, it's actually a long and colorful story. Let me just for a moment clarify what we mean by marijuana, because different people have different names for it. I tend to use the word cannabis because marijuana is just one of a series of nicknames, but we can use both. And it seems that marijuana was, or cannabis was, of which there are four species in the genus cannabis. One of these is Cannabis sativa L. The L is in honor of Carl Linnaeus, the famous Swedish biologist who gave us our classification system. And Cannabis sativa L is hemp, right? Now, hemp has its own history, and it's been used by a variety of cultures throughout history, as many people know, for paper, for clothes, for shoes, for rope, for canvas. The word canvas comes from the word cannabis. Our constitution was written on hemp, right, among other things. But hemp is not psychoactive. It has less than 1% THC. So I'm much more interested in the psychoactive types of cannabis, which include cannabis sativa without an L, cannabis indica. Indica is Latin for Indian, so it apparently indica was domesticated probably in the Himalayan mountains or so. And there's a fourth kind, Cannabis ruderalis, which was discovered by a Russian botanist in 1927. That's essentially irrelevant. So sativa apparently was domesticated in Mongolia. Now, I find this interesting because many people who like cannabis don't know much about its origins. It's a sun-loving plant. It lived on the fringes of the Pleistocene glaciers in northern Asia, on the edges of the Gobi Desert, and apparently was domesticated by some nomadic tribes that had been moving through the steppes and grasslands of Central Asia. We know this because there are burial tombs in Siberia and in Xinjiang in northwest China of noblemen who were buried with pounds of smokable cannabis in their tomb to kind of accompany them in the afterlife, Kurgan mounds, for example. Cannabis indica was probably domesticated in the Himalayas and gave rise to a thriving Indian tradition of cannabis use. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I'll just also point out, THC has to be heated in order for it to be psychoactive, and until the Europeans moved into the New World in the 16th century, smoking was essentially unknown in the old world. There were some pipes in Ethiopia and a couple of other places, but for the most part, people either cooked cannabis and put it in foods or soups, or they built small tents and burned a large quantity of it in a small fire and then inhaled the fumes from that.
Barney, at that time, was it used for medicinal, or was it ritual, or was it just pleasure?
Do they have any idea? It's hard to say because the historical record is pretty thin on this regard.
Mm-hmm.
Probably all of the above. Right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We know from ancient Chinese texts that date to about 2500 BC. That there certainly were medicinal purposes for smoking cannabis. There were medicinal texts that were written for the ruling aristocracy. There were Taoist rituals that revolved around it. There were books that said it was good for malaria and gout and other things. And the Chinese even developed a deity called the hemp weed. Right, the Chinese written symbol for cannabis, for ma, as it's called, is actually hemp leaves drying upside down. Right,
mm-hmm.
So it had a long tradition in China from about 2500 BC up until 600 AD. Some people suggest it's among the oldest crops that the human race has ever cultivated. Right,
mm-hmm.
In the 6th century AD, Confucianism took hold in China. And Confucianism really frowned on the smoking of cannabis. It still had associations with the Central Asian nomads that the Chinese were afraid of, and it threatened to kind of destabilize the social order. And Confucianism is a very conservative ideology that celebrates the social order, right?
Mm-hmm.
In India, kind of the opposite happened. As in China, you got this flourishing of cannabis culture there. It's meant smokable cannabis is mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita, one of the famed Hindu holy texts. There's an Ayurvedic tradition of medicine, Hindu medicine, that incorporates smoking cannabis. It's usually drunk in a drink called bhang, which is sort of cannabis tea mixed with milk, right? And it's often associated with the god Ganga, from which we get the word Ganga. It's cognate with the river Ganges, right? And even today, people go to temples and leave offerings of cannabis in honor of the god Shiva, right? So Central Asian nomads, the Chinese, and the Indians seem to be the kind of key players mm-hmm. in the early history.
And how did it travel throughout the world from there?
Well, there were a number of nomadic tribes kind of between Asia and the Middle East. At the time, one of the largest was a group called the Scythians, who had horses, and they sort of dominated an area ranging from Eastern Europe to Central Asia and Western China. And it was apparently the Scythians who carried smokable cannabis into the Middle East and into Europe. Around 2000 BC or so. So, for example, the Greek historian and geographer Herodotus was in the Crimean Peninsula hanging out with the Scythians, and he watched them build little tents and then gather in the tents and smoke it and have a good time. I mean, he sort of commented on that, right? And in classical Greece, there were all sorts of prescriptions for smoking cannabis. The famous Greek doctor Galen, who actually lived in the Roman Empire, but he prescribed it for toothaches and earaches and back pains during childbirth, for example. Right? And from there, it seems to have diffused up into Europe. We know that there were cannabis seeds, both hemp and smokable cannabis, in a variety of places in Europe. There were the Anglo-Saxons carried it to Britain, where we found evidence in medieval York and Scotland. The Vikings had cannabis on their ships. Merovingian queens were buried with cannabis. the 11th century nun and composer Hildegard von Bingen wrote about the joys of smoking cannabis. So there's this sort of hidden European tradition of cannabis, which we know very little about. In the Middle East, it's something of a different story. There are Egyptian hieroglyphs that mention cannabis, including prescriptions for different ailments, right? But it tended to flourish in the Arabic world when the Arabs kind of took over the Middle East in the 7th century. The Arabs had Quranic prohibitions against alcohol, so many of them turned to cannabis, and in particular hashish, which is the purified resin of cannabis. You might have heard of the story, which is probably not true, of the cult that would give young men large doses of hashish and said, well, this is what heaven is like, and then send them on suicidal assassination missions. And it's from hashish we get the word assassin. It was the hashashin where these young men were called.
Oh, that's cheery news. Wow, that's amazing.
It's kind of a famous tale, but it's not necessarily true. But we do know that cannabis spread far and wide throughout the Arab world. It got carried from Egypt to Morocco. It got carried into Spain in the 8th century. And the Arabs merchants carried it down the east coast of Africa, apparently to Ethiopia, where it was one of the only places that had pipes for smoking other than the New World, right? And down to southern Africa, where it was called Gaga. So the Europeans learned about cannabis. The British learned about it from the Indians, because India was a British colony for a long time. And the Portuguese and Spanish learned about it from the Africans. It's a long and colorful history there.
And how did it meander into the United States? Or I guess it's North and South America.
It was carried into the New World once by the Portuguese from Angola into Brazil on the heels of the slave trade. The colonialists liked cannabis because they would offer it to rewards to slaves after the workday was done, and it helped to keep them pacified. In Brazil, which was a Portuguese colony, it was very widespread. In fact, in the early 19th century, when the Portuguese royal court was fleeing the Napoleonic invasion of Spain, they moved to Rio de Janeiro. And when it was time to go back to Lisbon, the queen, Queen Carlotta, said, no way, I'm not going back to Lisbon. I like hanging out in Rio and smoking weed. So it's kind of a very funny story there. The Spanish introduced cannabis into places like Colombia, and it took hold in a variety of Spanish colonies there. There's networks of traveling salesmen called marihuaneros, began to carry it up into Central America. It was widely used by workers who were building the Panama Canal in the early 20th century. It was used by workers in Guatemala who were working for the United Fruit Company, right? And ultimately up into Mexico. And then roughly at the same time or slightly later, the British introduced cannabis from India through the British East India Company into Jamaica and Barbados and Trinidad. They were bringing Indian workers over with them, right? In Jamaica, it became sort of associated with the Rastafarians, who, as you may know, celebrate cannabis as the burning bush of the Old Testament. Right. So
That's interesting.
It's a very interesting kind of colonial story there.
Wow. Okay, that's quite a history, both in around the world. That's amazing.
I find it really interesting that there's so many cultures throughout the world that strive to alter their consciousness.
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing you there.
All right,
this is Yaw, by the way.
I'm the engineer of the show. Nice for you to call, Barney. I just made a point. I just find it interesting that how cultures throughout the world strive to alter their consciousness with with ganja and marijuana as one of their tools.
Right, and that was often seen in religious and mystical terms, you know. It's the idea of smoking purely for recreation seems to be a relatively modern phenomenon, right? Maybe from the 18th century on. Right?
Yeah, I agree.
There were people smoking hashish in Europe by the 18th century. There was kind of a whole cult of hashish smokers in France, for example, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one of my points is that for the most part, it was an entirely legal drug and often promoted by governments or corporations, like the British East India Company, who found it as a way to keep people quiet and minimize social unrest.
Mm-hmm. Barney, in your research, did you ever run across anything that pointed to the mixing of the psychedelic mushrooms and cannabis?
Well, that may have occurred. I am not familiar with that. I haven't read much about that, so I'm not sure to what extent that is true, right?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, cannabis and alcohol have often been used in conjunction, but mm-hmm. with mushrooms, I just don't know.
Psychedelic mushrooms has a really rich history as well, and kind of meandered the same way that cannabis did, but different routes. But I was just wondering, since they kind of happened simultaneous side by side, and actually I think that mushrooms popped up first, but if there was any trace evidence of any recipes or any rituals where they used both of them, but I think that would probably be kind of difficult to find.
Yeah, I don't know. It's clearly been used by a variety of cultures in different ways. So
right.
The story how it got into the U.S. is also kind of interesting, and mm-hmm. I think actually helps to shed light on the politics of criminalization and the war against drugs today.
Mm-hmm. Right? Okay, let's
talk
about that.
There were sailors who had brought cannabis to places like New Orleans in the 18th century or so. It was sometimes sold in liquid form as a medicine. So you see, you can just Google this, bottles of liquefied cannabis indica that were sold across in pharmacies and such, right? There was a small Arab community that was growing it in California in the late 19th century, right? But it was really not until the Mexican Revolution of 1910 to 1911 when a lot of refugees from Mexico began entering into places like Texas that cannabis began to find its way into the U.S. in large quantities, right? And it was often seen as a Mexican drug, something that only Latinos smoked. The African-American community picked it up from Mexicans because there was a lot of social interaction between the groups, and it became particularly popular among black musicians, such as in New Orleans. So by the 1920s and 1930s, there was a rich kind of musical culture that developed around cannabis in New Orleans, in St. Louis, in Chicago, in Harlem. We get songs like Cab Calloway's That Funny Reefer Man. Fats Waller did a song called Viper's Drag. Benny Goodman did a song called Sweet Marijuana Brown. All right. So, but my point is that its use was overwhelmingly associated with people of color, right? And that kind of lays the kind of racial groundwork for the criminalization of the 1930s.
Okay, and how did that come about?
Well, it's a long and sad history, and this is kind of what enraged me. Right? I'll point out the U.S. wasn't the first country to make cannabis illegal. South Africa did so in 1911. Canada did so in 1923, right? But the context of racism and the politics of the 1930s that I think we can see it the most clearly. Right?
Now, was that in those other countries as well, or is that just in the United States? when they...
Well, in other countries as well, but racism, I think, was the most overt in the U.S.
Okay.
Well, of course, South Africa, apartheid didn't exist in 1911, but it was still a white elite that ruled the country, right? And it was seen as a black people's drug there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at wars against drugs over time, they have always been racialized, right? Like the war against opium in the 19th century was linked to anti-Chinese racism, and the war against marijuana and the war against crack in the 1980s were all deeply racist in tone and nature, right? Some cities and states had begun to ban smokable cannabis in the early 20th century, so Massachusetts in 1913, California in 1915, the city of El Paso in 1915 all began to ban it. Some, like New York, said that it could only be obtained through a prescription, but possession was not illegal, right? But it wasn't until the 1930s that things began to get into high gear, right? And there's this particular conjunction of events in the 1930s that leads to the criminalization of marijuana, right? And that is closely associated with the end of the prohibition of alcohol, which began in 1919 and ended in 1933, right? And indeed, many of the people who waged war against cannabis were alcohol prohibitionists, right? The key figure in this regard was a guy named Harry Anslinger, right, who was a notorious racist, an admitted proud racist. And Anslinger was the head of a federal agency called the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, which would later evolve into the Drug Enforcement Agency. Right? So in 1933, when alcohol became legal, Anslinger looked around and to his cohort and said, "My God, what are we going to do? Is alcohol legal? There's really no point for us to be doing anything. We're going to be out of a job." And he conscientiously began to orchestrate a systematic campaign to make marijuana look horrible, right? This included having hearings, which in retrospect are kind of laughable, where doctors would testify that one smoke of marijuana would drive you insane permanently, right? I mean, there's absolutely no medical evidence whatsoever that went into the criminalization of marijuana. And in the 1930s, like in the mid-30s, Anslinger began to convince a number of Hollywood types to get on board. And it's then that you begin to get, like, hilarious movies like Reefer Madness. I mean, it's a cult classic today. It appeared in 1936, right? And the typical trope of these movies was a black man uses smokable weed to seduce a white girl, right? And nothing stirred up white fears and anxieties like that, right? As an aside, I'll point out, there is sort of an urban myth that the people who tried to make cannabis illegal included folks like Hearst, who owned a string of newspapers in California and engaged in sordid yellow journalism of the worst kind, and the DuPont Corporation. They owned vast tracts of forest land, right? And the claim has been made that improvements in the harvesting of hemp was going to make it competitive with paper, and they stood to lose any profits from the sale of pulpwood from their forests, right? But that claim is actually not really backed up by any solid evidence. It mostly is based on a single book by a guy named Jack Herer called The Emperor Wears No Clothes, right? And there's really very little factual evidence to sustain that claim. I think it's much more plausible that Hearst and others were simply racist, and they were following Anslinger and found it convenient to demonize marijuana as a way of waging war against Mexicans and black people.
Right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Marty, I'm going to interrupt you 1 second here because I want to reintroduce who you are. We're listening to Professor Barney Warf. He's with the Department of Geography from the University of Kansas. And he's written a paper, and he's written many books just on other subjects, but he's quite accomplished, and he has a strong interest in cannabis, and he's sharing his information with us. And at 5:45, we're going to open up the lines for questions. If anyone has a question, please feel free to call. The number is
826-7771.
Okay, and please feel free to call, and I'm sure Barney would be happy to answer your questions. So, okay, now, where do we need anything else?
I just want to let folks know that you're listening to the Kauai Island Hemp Show, and this is KKCR Honolulu, KAQA, Kilauea, Kauai Community Radio.
All righty, Mr. Warf. Okay, so where are we now?
Okay, well,
we're talking about DuPont. I'm sorry?
Right. Well, in 1937, Congress passed the Marijuana Tax Act, which essentially said you had to buy stamps in order to buy or sell marijuana. And anyone caught buying or selling without a stamp would be subject to fines of $100 per ounce, which would be something like $2,500 in today's currency. And that essentially criminalized marijuana at the federal level, right? So it's been illegal in all states since 1937 as a result, right? Yeah. In the 1960s, when the baby boom started to go to college, is when white America discovered weed, and young whites began to smoke it as a symbol of protest against the establishment and so forth, right? And in some ways, I think the nadir of this process occurred under Richard Nixon in the early 70s. Nixon commissioned a study of marijuana, and his own panel of experts declared that it posed no health risk and should be legalized, right? And incidentally, the American Medical Association, which opposed the Stamp Act of 37, also said it should be legalized. And Nixon ignored the advice of his own commission and instead not only kept it illegal, he made cannabis a Schedule I drug, which puts it in a category with heroin and LSD and bufetamine that you only get by licking toads, right? So it has no possible health purposes. And one reason there's been so little medical research into the health effects of cannabis is because it's still listed as a Schedule I drug, right? Which is just simply outrageous, if you're asking me, right?
Uh-huh.
And again, not based on scientific evidence, but based on the racism of the 1930s and opportunistic politicians.
Right? Yeah, I'm sure that the pharmaceutical companies have a big interest in continuing to keep the blanket on that also. At least that's...
Well, I would think they might be interested in legalization if they could sell it, but it's too much of a political hot potato, and I don't.
You think so?
Hear it.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It seems like to me that, you know, they'd like to get the corner on it, and so one of the things that they're going to do. I mean, this is just my opinion, and you know, what do I know? But it just seems like one of the things that is going to be important when you're buying it from dispensaries is how much, and what kind of product are you buying? So, which means that it has to be regulated. So if it's regulated,
right,
then they got it because they can provide regulations. They can provide all the tasties and all the whatevers you want, and because they can say, okay, they've got the specifics. This is exactly, this is sativa, this is whatever it is, and whatever the amounts are. So I think that's how it's
right.
going to run down, but that's just me. So anyway, go ahead.
Well, today, marijuana is the most common illegal drug in the world, right? Only one country has outright made it legal, and that's Uruguay, although it's essentially legal in places like the Netherlands, right? And most estimates are that something like 15 million Americans consume it once a week or more, right? Which is about 4% of the population or so.
Wait a minute, Barney, go back up a second. You said that there's only one country that it's legal? All the rest of the countries in the world, it's illegal?
Uruguay
really?
Has made growing, buying, selling, possessing completely legal. It's the most advanced country in the world. In
really?
This regard,
right? Okay, thank you for clarifying that. That was kind of a shocker.
Yeah, it is interesting. And, you know, in many places, like in much of Canada, it might be nominally illegal, like in British Columbia, but the law is really only on the books and nobody ever enforces it, right? Mm-hmm. And ditto in the Netherlands, right? But nonetheless, we still have a war on marijuana, despite the lack of medical evidence that it's ever hurt anyone, right? So I just want to point out, every year in the United States, tobacco kills 480,000 people. Right? Every year, alcohol kills 200,000 people in the U.S., right? How many people have ever died from cannabis? The answer is zero. There has never been one documented case of anybody ever dying from an overdose of smoking weed. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying smoking cannabis is good for you. It may or may not be. But because we don't have much good scientific evidence, we don't really know the health effects, right? But nonetheless, 700,000 people are arrested annually for the possession of marijuana. That's something like one every 30 seconds, right?
Oof.
Black people are six times more likely to be arrested for weed than white people are. So, again, the war on drugs is a war on people of color, right? In some states, like Texas, the possession of weed carries penalties making you ineligible for food stamps, and that's a penalty that does not apply to murderers, right?
Wow.
So the penalty for something that has never hurt anybody is worse than that for being a murderer. We subsidize tobacco, and yet we criminalize marijuana. I just find it an act of mass psychosis.
Oh, that's saying it lightly. Wow.
It's just astonishing how irrational it is,
yeah.
Right? And fortunately, that irrationality has begun to be exposed and gradually overturned. I've been surprised and delighted at the success of the cannabis legalization movement. It has just succeeded beyond anyone's sort of imagination, right?
And what do you
the same way that the gay marriage movement has enjoyed great success?
Right. What do you contribute that to? What do you think is the the driving force there?
Well, in my mind, there are two sets of forces that have been driving the legalization movement. One of these is a sea change in public attitudes towards marijuana. The younger generation, which is much more familiar and comfortable with it, and less likely to believe the hype about it, they tend to be much more favorably predisposed to it, right? So the latest poll by the Pew Charitable Trust put 54% of Americans favoring legalization of recreational marijuana. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So the majority of the public supports it, but that doesn't mean politicians will do what the public wants, because they rarely do, right? 25 states have legalized medical marijuana, right? Others have decriminalized possession but don't allow the sale, right? And four, Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and Colorado, have legalized recreational marijuana, and several others, like California, will vote on it this coming November, right? And then the other force I think that's driving this is a number of conservative state legislatures have begun to change their views because they see Colorado and Colorado schools that have been flush with revenues to the tune of $80 million a year from taxes on cannabis and cannabis products.
Wow,
in Colorado. Right?
Yeah, wow, that's a big chunk.
When they passed the legalization of recreational marijuana in Colorado, they earmarked the money for education, and it made it much more palatable to voters. Right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you get in Colorado, marijuana hotels, marijuana lawyers, marijuana grow lights and associated equipment, right? And it's generated lots of funds, and So a number of states are looking at legalizing at least medical marijuana. I live in Kansas, which is a very conservative state, and they're thinking about legalizing medical marijuana, right? So is Alabama, right? Nevada, which is a very conservative state legislature, has made the use of any medical card from any state in the country legal in Nevada, right? So even many conservatives, I think more out of dire necessity than anything else, have kind of come around on this point. Right? So the combination of a change in public opinion, particularly among the young, and many state legislatures grudgingly admitting the need for the tax dollars has kind of propelled legalization and will continue to do so in the future.
My. Okay. So that's where does that bring us up to today? What's happening like right now? I mean, are we like on the verge, or are we, you know, do you think it's going to take a lot more time? Where do you think we are in that, in our timetable?
Well, I mean, I said that the legalization movement has enjoyed unprecedented success with a remarkable speed, right? But I think it's also equally important not to get carried away and become overly optimistic, right? I have friends who were saying in the 1960s that marijuana would be legal by 1970, and of course that didn't happen, right?
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
I guess given the long and sordid history of marijuana in the U.S., I'm extremely cautious about being too optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, the events of the last few years have kind of demonstrated that the ground rules have shifted, right? And it could well be that over the next few years, a number of states begin to relax their restrictions on it. I hope they begin to let some of the hundreds mm-hmm. of thousands of people in jail for having pot out of jail, right? That would be a good first step, right? And I think President Obama should just remove it from the Schedule I list. He doesn't need congressional approval to do that, right? And that at least would allow research into the medical effects of marijuana, both good and bad,
mm-hmm.
right?
Do you think there's a chance of that happening before he leaves office?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's possible. Maybe he'll do it on the last day he's in office or something, right?
He'd be a national hero.
A future president.
Yeah.
I've always viewed the medical marijuana movement as something of a fig leaf, right? I'm sympathetic to it. I know a number of people smoke marijuana for glaucoma and the pains associated with chemotherapy, and if it does them good, more power to them. But in many states, I think the medical marijuana is just a thinly veiled veneer for what is essentially legal recreational marijuana, right? So I was in Venice, California a few days ago, and on the boardwalk there, they have doctors where you can get your license for $50 right on the spot and buy an ounce right on the spot as well, right?
Oh, that's a one-stop shop.
Yeah, a one-stop shop. It makes the prohibitions against marijuana into kind of a joke, if you will,
right?
So I say let's just remove the fig leaf, legalize recreational marijuana all over the country, study it scientifically. If there are adverse health effects, let's know about it through carefully designed double-blind studies, right? And, you know, let's approach this in a systematic and scientific way, and let's be done with the kind of racist discourses that have framed how marijuana has been viewed for more than half a century, right?
Mm-hmm.
For 80 years now,
mm-hmm.
right? That people still have these kind of unrealistic stereotypes about it, which are utterly untrue.
Right. My question, Barney, is the old guard, I'll say the folks that are still supporting the prohibition of marijuana, what are some of their points that they use that are legit to keeping it illegal?
Well, I don't think they have a legal stand on.
That's the way it's always been.
they can't make an argument, right, that it's bad for you, first of all, because there's very little research on it. And I think even among the old guard, there's kind of a change in opinions. So, for example, there are tour groups now that leave Kansas and take groups of elderly people to Colorado, and there they buy weed and get high. You're not allowed to take it out of Colorado, right? So they have to smoke it all on the premises. Then they get back in their bus and go back to Kansas, right? So I've always imagined a bus driver there with a group of 50 stoned old people right in the back, right?
They're all giggling and laughing and having a good time.
Right. If many elderly people even like it for whatever reason, mm-hmm. then more power to them, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
It annoys the hell out of me that Republicans who talk about getting government off our backs and government shouldn't intrude in our private lives, but then when it comes to kind of keeping cannabis illegal, right, they're also in favor of that. The hypocrisy is just intolerable.
Mm-hmm. I think we're going to go ahead.
Oh, we've got about 15 minutes left of the show, and we were going to open the phone lines to folks listening out there if they have any questions for you, Barney. So if anybody wants to call in, 826-7771, to join this conversation with Barney Warf, a professor University of Kansas, the Department of Geography. He's been did extensive research. I've learned a lot, and I thought I knew a lot, and I thank you so much for taking time out and educating me all the more about this. So,
sure, happy to do so.
I have a question. What's your thoughts on the dispensaries and the dispensary movement across the states that have it legal?
Well, medical dispensaries.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Those play a useful role. My understanding is that in some places, dispensaries have begun to decline in importance.
Oh, really?
Because there are services where you can just call up and someone will bring the bag to your door, right?
Mm.
And for people who might be afraid to be seen going into a dispensary or something like that, or just want the convenience of home delivery, right? The alternative kind of approach seems to be more successful. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but I'm sure that dispensaries exist not only in states like Colorado or Oregon, but also in California. Right? There's been sort of a troubled legal relationship between the Obama administration and the dispensaries because he initially said he would not take any legal action against them, and then later federal agents were raiding dispensaries in California. So there's a bit of uncertainty there.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Barney, we have a caller who has a question. Caller, are you there?
I am here.
Okay. Feel free to ask your question.
Okay, Professor Barney, great discussion. Thank you. I'm curious with the sativa and the indica, which of those varieties are predominant in what people are just buying, on the street or in other places, and also what are the difference in the properties as you would describe them?
Well, this takes us into a realm of biochemistry, which I'll confess I have very limited knowledge of, right? What gets people high in the smoking of marijuana is THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, right, which is one of several cannabinoids, as they're called. THC was discovered by Israeli scientists in 1964, right? But there are different types of cannabinoids that have different effects, right? And I always get this mixed up, so forgive me if I'm getting this wrong, but it's something like sativa tends to have cannabinoids that affect the brain more, and so you get what's called a head high, and indica has cannabinoids that affect the body more, right? Some people get sleepy, some people get sexually aroused, right? Some people's hearing gets temporarily depressed, and their memory may suffer a short-term loss, right, kind of impairment, right? And I might have that backwards.
No, you don't. No,
there are people who
correct.
Know the biochemistry in great detail and can tell you which cannabinoids and which subspecies affects, and gets you what effects. I think there must be online kind of encyclopedias that could inform one about this in great detail.
Mm-hmm.
A great question.
Mm-hmm.
And which are the most common as people, tend to run into in their buying it either at these dispensaries or on the street?
I don't know if there's any data on this. My sense is that sativa is the most common in the United States, although I've met people who prefer indica. So certainly both varieties are out there, and there are all sorts of sub-varieties, you know, because you have growers who have been developing different strains, usually with very colorful names, right, over time. Some of the most intense competition occurs at the Cannabis Cup in Amsterdam every year, where the prize-winning seeds then get a great deal of notoriety, and that particular strain becomes very expensive. So there's actually high stakes involved in winning the Cannabis Cup, right? And I've always imagined what it would be like to be a judge at the Cannabis Cup.
Be a lot of work, I would think.
Well, I wouldn't call it work.
Well, I don't know. Go ahead.
Thank you, caller. Are you done?
Thank you, folks.
Yeah, yeah. Have a nice day. Thank you. I want to let everybody know that Cousin Rich is in the house, and Can You Dig It Jazz is 10 minutes away. Right now, feel free to give us a call, 826-7771. We're on the phone with Barney Warf, a professor at the University of Kansas in the Department of Geography, but has a wealth of knowledge dealing with cannabis. Barney, I want to give you a little... the way I remember sativa and indica is indica, think of it as in the couch, and because that's the one that makes you sleepy. So when you indica is the sleepy one because it puts you in the couch.
Okay, so that must be, I guess I had it right then.
You
it's
did
more of a body.
Yeah.
Okay. I always worry that I've got them confused, you know. So.
Yeah. It looks like we got another caller here. Okay, go ahead.
Hey, I'd like your caller to qualify something that he said. He said that Nevada is honoring medical marijuana licenses from the other states. Is that true? If that's true,
yes.
They're the only state who has ever even attempted to do something like that. I'll take that off the air.
That's quite likely. Yeah, they may be the only state that have done that, right? But it is true that it's testimony to the desire of the legislature to encourage consumption there, or at least sales there, in the hopes of generating tax revenues. You know, there are often particular excise taxes on marijuana, like in Colorado and Washington and elsewhere. It's not cheap, right? I think Nevada, you know, does that with an eye towards the tax revenues.
Not only that, but there. I mean, what a big welcome mat for people who smoke to come in, not feel like they can't.
I would think the tourist dollars would be an incentive. I always thought maybe Kauai could do something that like Amsterdam did, because I had a lot of friends who decided to fly all the way to Amsterdam just for that reason.
Right. Right. Yeah, I mean, weed tourism has become kind of an industry in its own right. It's just, and, you know, there are other places as well. I mean, Spain has taken a pretty lax line on this, and Switzerland even. Right? So
we're going to see.
Europeans tend to be much more relaxed.
We're going to see Bud and Breakfast open up across the country, I think.
I'm sure there must be one already open under that name.
Yeah, well. Why not? Oh, what was that?
The wake and bake. Bed and breakfast kind of stuff.
Yeah, I guess you can go.
Stop with the buns.
So, Barney, are you going to continue your research on this subject? What's going to happen with your material? It's pretty extensive.
I may continue this. I want to see what happens over the next year or so, right? Sort of shifting from the historical roots of it and focusing more on the battle for legalization in the U.S. And again, as I said at the outset, because I view it as a human rights and social justice issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm fascinated by the changing popular attitudes toward it. I think the U.S. is in the midst of a massive sea change in political opinions, right? If you look at people under 30, they're
far more likely to be atheists. They're far more likely to be tolerant of gay marriage. They're far more likely to support weed legalization, right? And over the next several years, that is going to become a potent force in political debates, right? I would like to say it might become an unstoppable force, but as I noted a little earlier, I prefer to be very cautious about this, right? Mm-hmm. So I want to see who legalizes recreational marijuana in the next couple of years, right? How Canada, deals with this issue, right? And how some European countries do, and even in parts of Latin America, it's beginning to change. Now, I think Asia tends to be much more conservative on this front, right? So I don't expect to see much happening there.
It's interesting because the history shows that, you know, they've had it for, you know, like you said, for thousands of years.
And, you know, who knows what's going on but behind closed doors also, you know?
That's possible, but we don't really know. And India, of course, it's still quite popular, but the Eastern Asian countries, I think, tend to frown on it much more heavily. And Paul McCartney was arrested with marijuana in the Tokyo airport a number of years ago. Right?
Yeah, I just think that was a celebrity deal. You know, they just wanted to get him. But anyway, yeah, it's true.
You know, I think as the baby boomers age and pass on, I think that's when the potential for legalization will come forward.
Is there any dangers in this movement going too quickly, Barney? Do you see anything that's going to, you know, turn around and bite everybody in the butt?
Well, I don't think there is such a thing as moving too quickly on this issue, right? And I would like to see all the people behind bars released, preferably with compensation for their time served, right?
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to other drugs other than marijuana, I begin to get much more cautious. Mm-hmm. I tend to take kind of a libertarian view of drugs. I'm not a libertarian at heart, but I don't think the government should be telling us what we can put in our bodies. But I want very clear safeguards for children, and this goes for marijuana as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it should be available to anyone under 18. We've got to be sure it's not sold near schools. Make sure people don't drive high because that's not safe, right? People should treat it in a mature and conscientious and respectful way and not let it become a problem, like not let it interfere with work, not let it interfere with their social life, right? Treat it for what it is, a recreational drug, and it should be handled with care and with limits and not smoke too much because, like alcohol or anything else, doing too much kind of makes it less fun, right? There's no real evidence that marijuana is physiologically addictive. It might be psychologically addictive, right? And you get sort of young people who feel they have to smoke it because they just can't handle the stress of life. And they're like, well, get over it. Life is stressful, right?
Yeah,
so, you know, I'm not advocating that everybody spend 24 hours a day getting stoned. I just think that responsible people who use it responsibly should be given the freedom to do so.
Okay, well, that is a wonderful ending of the show. We have to wrap it up here. We're almost out of time. And I just can't thank you enough for you taking your time and all this fabulous information.
Thanks.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It was a joy talking with you guys.
Absolutely. Thanks, Barney Ward, professor at University of Kansas.
Yeah, and if anybody has any questions for Barney, you can email me, dianalabetz@aol.com, and I can forward that on to Mr. Wharf. So, again, thank you.
Send the paper.
Right, that's true. I've got the paper. I'll send you a copy of his paper. It's fascinating.
Wow. All right.
All righty.
Thank you so much.
Okay, have a wonderful evening. Thanks, Barney.
Bye.
Bye for now.
And I want to say thanks to KKCR for supporting the Kauai Hemp Show. Thanks to Dinah Littlebetz for putting this all together. And we'll see you next month, third Monday. And Cousin Rich is next with Can You Dig It Jazz. We'll be back.
Born inside a hospital with a 9-digit number code. I pledged allegiance to the flag when I was only 4 years old. The first thing that I learned in school is we are a country free. One bad red forces attack our land, I'll fight for my country. I'll fight for my country. I joined the scouts when I was 12 and put on a uniform. I learned there how to fold the flag and how the look of a proud man was worn. We camped in the